I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. On April 25th, three New York City police officers were acquitted on all counts of shooting Sean Bell. In 2006, the officers fired 50 bullets at Bell and his friends as they were leaving Bell's bachelor party. Bell was unarmed. There were only muted protests following the verdict, but today the Reverend Al Sharpton, members of Bell's family, and other community leaders are taking these protests one step further. They'll march and stage pray-ins throughout New York City. One of the sites is House of the Lord Church in downtown Brooklyn, led by the Reverend Herb Daughtry. We talked to the Reverend yesterday about his plans for the protest.
What we propose to do is assemble at various sites around the city and then march to the action site. That is the place where we will submit ourselves, some of us, to an arrest. Hopefully, in so doing, we will tie up the city so that there would be no movement, no motion. And everybody in the city, and indeed across the nation, will get the message that we will not stand for policemen, the people we pay to protect us, to kill us.
Reverend, when you talk about blocking things off and shutting things down, does that mean that you will literally block the streets?
Obviously, I don't want to be too specific, but we have assembling points, points where we tell people to assemble. Here in Brooklyn, it's at our church, the House of the Lord Church. Now, once people have assembled, then we will go to the designated sites of action where the civil disobedience will take place.
Sean Bell was a young man. Have you been able to reach out to people who were in their 20s? Or even in their teens, to try to get them to join on to this protest?
Oh, by all means. I mean, the family in particular has been courageous. I've been at this 50 years now, and sometimes families withdraw, and we understand that. But this family has been a model of participation in all of the rallies, the demonstrations that we've had, and some of the members will be arrested. Therefore, they have sent a message across the city, indeed across the nation, rallying young people, because Sean was about 22, 23, rallying young people to this cause.
Now, you and Reverend Sharpton's National Action Network were involved in protests around the shooting death of Amadou Diallo. Civil disobedience played a big role in those protests. What do you think those protests taught you, or what did you learn from them?
Well, you know, we've been doing this across the years. There's nothing new about a civil disobedience. But having 1,200 people arrested in a daily civil disobedience venture is phenomenal. It made an impact upon the police department itself and upon the politics in New York. Giuliani was the mayor at that time, we hope. That we will have a residential law. That is to say that policemen should live where they work. So that would mean you kill where you live. And I suspect that if you're going to kill where you live, you'd be more inclined not to kill. And we hope that there would be an independent civilian complaint review board that would review the behavior of the police.
Reverend, if you are not imprisoned on civil disobedience charges, would you be willing to come on tomorrow and update us about the protest?
I'd be delighted to do so.
Well, Reverend, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
The Reverend Herb Daughtry leads the House of the Lord Church in downtown Brooklyn. We're going to debate the possible impact of Reverend Al Sharpton's New York pray-in, weigh in on the Indiana and North Carolina primary results, and remember the pioneer of interracial marriage laws, Mildred Loving. That's all on today's Bloggers Roundtable. With us, Carmen Van Kerkhove. She blogs at Racialicious. She's also the co-founder and president of New Demographic, an anti-racism training company. And Baratunde Thurston. He's a blogger for sites including the Huffington Post. He also writes for Jack and Jill Politics under the pseudonym Jack Turner. Plus, education analyst Casey Lartig. His blog is The Casey Lartig Show. Welcome, folks.
Thank you for inviting us.
Hey, thanks for having us.
So we just heard from Reverend Herb Daughtry of the House of the Lord Church in Brooklyn. His storefront church is one of the places people are meeting today on their way to pray-ins. They're protesting the verdict in the trial of three NYPD detectives who shot and killed Sean Bell. Two of the officers who fired at Bell were black themselves. Now, Al Sharpton is spearheading the protest. He says the goal of the pray-ins is to actually shut down New York City. Baratunde and Carmen, you are in New York. Baratunde first, what are people saying about the protest?
Well, I'm getting some excitement from some people that something's actually happening. You know, Black Agenda Report had a great phrase to describe the decision. They said that the decision may have been legal, but it wasn't just. And there's a strong sense in the community that this was an act of injustice, that justice was not served. So on the one hand, you have people who are glad that something's going down. There's always conflicted feelings raised when it's Al Sharpton who is sort of leading something, and he's a double-edged sword. He can bring a spotlight like no other, but he also brings a spotlight like no other.
Carmen, what about that double-edged sword of Al Sharpton's involvement?
Yeah, I think Sharpton is definitely a controversial figure. I think it's great on the one hand that, you know, African Americans have someone like him to really, you know, draw attention to issues. But on the other hand, there are a lot of white folks who really regard him as some kind of a huckster and a race baiter. And so it definitely is a double-edged sword, just as Baratunde said.
Now, after the verdict, many people expected large and immediate protests, but the city was relatively quiet. Now, when you think about this, Casey, why do you think there was a delayed reaction? And also, let me ask you, are black folks in D.C. even paying attention to this case?
First of all, I haven't heard about people boarding buses to get to New York to protest this. And there's been very little talk, as far as I've heard, on black talk radio locally. I mean, obviously some, but not within the last couple of days. But I think the problem that the reason there hasn't been a lot of action is what the two other guests have mentioned, and that is Al Sharpton. I mean, with so much nonsense mixed in, it's hard to tell what is injustice and what is street theater with them. Because, you know, he'll take delusional women and criminals at their word. So it's hard for us to take him at his word when he says, here's something that you need to get involved in. So, and you know, it's not just about Sharpton, because I've got my suspicions about people like Alan Dershowitz, because, you know, if you're his client, I'm suspicious. And I think that's the kind of thing that's happened with Sharpton. People are just always suspicious.
I also think, if I might jump in really quickly, that there's some set of fatigue. We've had so many cases like this. It's obvious that we have a dual
justice system. Think about it. Tawana Brawley, Duke rape case, Crown Heights, Benson Hurst. I mean, Freddie's Fashion Mart, Diallo, Jenna 6, some good, some bad. But he's always there. He has all the credibility of a public defender. You just had your little promo earlier about public defenders.
Now, we've got some bloggers that we've been checking out, and one of them wrote, there's a lot less anger over this verdict than Al Sharpton thinks. Most black folks realize that Bell was shot by black people. Relax, Al. Nobody is getting too upset over your silly protest. Impacting the commerce in New York only hurts your community. Carmen, do you think, I mean, this is something that has come up again and again, especially with the Jenna 6 case, which did rally huge amounts of people to one fixed location. Do you think protests are, I mean, how important are they to modern civil rights and legal rights?
I think protests are still a very effective tool, because anytime you can get a large number of people together in one place, that creates a good visual spectacle for a very image-driven media. However, I do want to address the point about the fact that, you know, some of the cops involved were people of color themselves. And I think a lot of people, you know, really harp on this fact. But here's the thing. I mean, the media is constantly bombarding us with images that really criminalize young black men. And so it's not as if you are a person of color yourself, you're automatically shielded from internalizing some of this stuff. So it's absolutely possible for black cops, Latino cops, to have the same sort of, you know, gut reactions about criminalizing young black men in their minds and thus reacting violently. And so I really think that that's an important point that we should really discuss.
And I'd say more important than their race, you know, whether they're black or white, is they're blue. And they hide behind the shield of the power of the state. And it's the state here, not the color of the officers, that has this pattern of criminalizing and killing black people way beyond the numbers that would be just.
Yeah, but, you know, this is the old problem that very often there are incidents that if the Ku Klux Klan or some white people were involved, that black people would be out rallying, ready to just burn stuff down. But they're a little more confused when it is a case like this where there are black people involved. And then it becomes a question of, okay, so you got a guy who's, you know, a former drug dealer who allegedly was trying to run over the cops. So then it's like, it's not such an easy case as it would be like, what, they're white cops. They
all
obviously
right.
must have been after him because he's black.
I want to go into a speed round here on this one topic because we've talked quite a bit about it, and that is the elections. You know, Senator Obama completely sweeping North Carolina and Senator Clinton getting 3% victory over in Indiana. So speed round, what do you think's going to happen, you know, over the course of the next few weeks? Baratunde.
I am just happy to welcome the mainstream media to the Democratic primary. They finally caught on to the wrath of the math, which hasn't changed much since Obama's 12-state sweep post-Super Tuesday. And that, I think, is the biggest change. The facts on the ground haven't changed. The media narrative and perception is very important, and it has, and I'm glad to see that it's happening.
Carmen?
Yeah, I mean, I think Baratunde and a lot of other bloggers have really brought up this angle in the media, which has been very much harping on whether Obama can win the white vote and not really asking whether Hillary Clinton can win the black vote. And so I'm glad to finally see that question being raised more and more. And, you know, hopefully let's wrap this thing up.
Casey?
Yeah, ultimately, I mean, there's going to be a big fight. But in the end, 85 to 90% of black people are going to vote for Democrats and, again, have their votes taken for granted.
I want to move on finally to the passing of a woman named Mildred Loving. She passed away on Friday. Her last name always reminded people of her place in history. She and her husband, who was white, changed history in 1967 when the U.S. Supreme Court upheld their right to marry. The state of Virginia, even at that late date, forbade interracial marriage, and their case changed laws across the country. So Mildred Loving rarely gave interviews, but last year on the 40th anniversary of the case, she said, "I am proud that Richards and my name is on a court case that can help reinforce the love, the commitment, the fairness, and the family that so many people, black or white, young or old, gay or straight, seek in life. I support the freedom to marry for all." That's what Loving and Loving are all about. Carmen, how significant was this case and Mildred Loving?
It was very significant. I mean, it was definitely groundbreaking. One thing that a lot of people don't realize is after the Loving versus Virginia Act was passed, a lot of states continued to keep the anti-miscegenation laws on their books, even though they weren't allowed to really enforce them. And what's interesting is that in 2000, the state of Alabama held a special election to decide whether or not to take those laws off the books. And over 40% of the residents voted to keep the laws. And so I think that really is an eye-opening fact in showing that there is still a lot of opposition to interracial relationships in this day and age.
Baratunde, Virginia used to be the heart of the Confederacy. And when you think about outlawing interracial marriage, there have been interracial relationships, some of them coerced, including rape during the days of slavery, some of them consensual. Is it ironic that there's so much mixed blood in virtually all African Americans, but that the law said people could not marry?
I don't quite consider it ironic. I think it's a vestige of the fears and the commitment to white supremacy that our laws have so often reflected. And it still shocks me that this was only 40 years ago. We have a very strong image of our country as super progressive and enlightened. But 40 years is not that long ago. And 2000, as Carmen just pointed out, is even closer. I also love that Loving said equal rights for all marriages, that in a day and age when same-sex couples are denied their rights, we have the same conversation going on. And I think it's actually time to keep extending equal marriage rights under the law to all of our citizens.
Casey, some countries, including South Africa, have laws on the books, you know, national laws saying that gays and lesbians can marry. Do you think that when Mildred Loving says something like what she says, do you think that there's room for a groundswell of support among African Americans, among Americans as a whole, to really reconsider the issue of gay marriage, which has been so far very controversial, very much a wedge issue?
Yeah, it probably won't happen because I think, unfortunately, a lot of people still look at it as, you know, it was because of race that we were denied. But now it's because, you know, I mean, if you're gay, you can kind of hide it. You can still have your life. But I think we need to focus on that this is about the relationship of consenting adults with their government. And that is that you're able, when you come up with your marital plans, that you don't have to tell the government. I mean, you have to give the government notification, but you don't have to seek permission. we need to focus more on the fact that as an individual, I can choose the person that I want to marry, again, as an adult.
Finally, it's all about attitude at this point. And there are a lot of people who still don't like interracial relationships. There's an upswing in black women marrying outside the race. The black men still have the lead. Baratunde, among your extended cohort, do you get the sense that people are accepting or suspicious of interracial relationships?
Yes, and both. I think you always find throughout history probably that younger people are much more open to things that buck some of the rules of older society. So among my peers, there's a pretty open attitude, although there are still tensions, obviously, due to the historical context that we can't ever fully escape.
Carmen?
Yeah, I mean, I think that race gets very sexualized, and so there are always a lot of underlying suspicions about people's motivations for getting into interracial relationships. You know, is it just some kind of fetish, some kind of fascination? And so I think, you know, that overall there's more acceptance, but that acceptance isn't really complete, and I think it comes with a lot of underlying assumptions and question marks.
All right, we're going to have to wrap it up. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Baratunde Thurston. He blogs at the Huffington Post and Jack and Jill Politics, plus Carmen Van Kerkhove, who blogs at Racialicious. Both were at our New York studios. And Casey Lartigue's blog is called The Casey Lartigue Show. He was at our headquarters in Washington, D.C. You can find links to their blogs and ours at nprnewsandnotes.org. And the conversation doesn't stop here. Our online series, Speak Your Mind, gives you a chance to sound off on the issues you care about. To find out how, go to our blog, nprnewsandviews.org. And click on Speak Your Mind. That's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, how the Stop Snitching movement is making vendetta justice the only justice in some urban communities.